Bill Ott, editor and publisher of the American Library Association's book list, tells us, "When I was 14 years old, I saw the movie version of Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's and concluded that being a writer in New York was the coolest thing a person could do in life, possibly even cooler than playing center field for the Giants. The actual writing part was a little fuzzy. We only see George Papard as Paul Varjak sitting at his typewriter a couple of times. But the perks were fantastic. Hanging out in the city, going to truly live, wild parties where people made out in the bathtub, having Henry Mancini provide the soundtrack to your life." And of course, living downstairs from Audrey Hepburn, who, if you were sufficiently sensitive and helped her find her cat, would fall into your arms as Moon River played over the credits. "Sign me up for the full package, please," Ott continues. "A few years later, by which time I believed I'd become ever so worldly and cynical, I read Capote's novella. Well, I didn't quite finish it for the simple reason that I wasn't ready to let go of my vision of Paul Varjak, complete with a typewriter, a cat named Cat, and a girl called Holly Golightly. Don't get me wrong, I knew that one never admitted to liking the movie better than the book, and I knew that George Papard was a long way from an A-list actor, but darn it, in Capote's story, the narrator doesn't even have a name, so there's no scene where Holly tries to introduce Varjak Paul, just like in the card catalog, to a formidable New York Public Library librarian. I loved that scene in the movie, and I refused to have my breakfast at Tiffany's without it." Flash forward about 40 years, and an advanced copy of the 50th anniversary edition of Breakfast at Tiffany's, issued by Vintage, lands on my desk. Am I finally ready for a breakfast alternative? Yes, of course. With the book, though, there's no Mancini and no romantic ending and, sadly, no Varjak Paul. But there is a double serving of Holly's voice. We remember Capote for the perfect crispness of his prose, but he could also write bravura monologues. Holly in full cry is nothing short of spectacular. Much of Holly's screen dialogue comes straight from the book, but there's more of it on the page, and it's far saucier. Here's an example. "I'd rob a grave, I'd steal two bits off a dead man's eyes if I thought it would contribute to the day's enjoyment." Don't think for a minute, though, that I'm turning my back on Varjak Paul. Breakfast at Tiffany's, the movie, is still the best darn romantic fantasy about being a writer ever to hit the big screen, and I'm going to go right on lapping up the final scene in the rain with Cat, Holly, and Moon River like I always have. But just because I sometimes like a deliciously sweet bonbon for breakfast doesn't mean I can't enjoy a perfectly turned omelet when the mood is right. Words of Bill Ott, editor and publisher of the American Library Association's book list, in an essay in American Libraries. As Bill Ott suggests, it doesn't have to be either or. And what if there's a third possibility? Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's has been adapted for the stage by Richard Greenberg, and there will be a production September 14th, 15th, and 16th, 21st, 22nd, 23rd, at the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts in Hazleton. We had a visit from cast and directors, Fred, Bill Amos, Mag Wildwood, Natasha Bogutsky, assistant director Donna Wojtek, and director John Sugard.
I would recommend if you're not familiar with Breakfast at Tiffany's at all, come see the play and then see the film. You'll enjoy comparing the differences.
Oh, yes. It was almost like when we did Heathers. You mentioned that the play will get you ready for the movie, but the movie doesn't get you ready for the play.
I would agree with that.
I was a big fan of the movie as a kid. And then I got out to audition and I found out that it is not the movie at all. It is far from it. It is much more steeped in drama and realism of its time period. And that's what kind of drew me to it. It wasn't just so much, oh, Holly Golightly and the romantic attachments that she has with her neighbor and all that. That's not there. It is to a certain degree, but it's twisted. It is slightly twisted.
I think the main thing is that Richard Greenberg, the fellow who did the stage adaptation, he went back to Truman Capote's novella as opposed to going to the film, because the film takes a lot of liberties with the story, even to the point of changing the time frame. The film is set in the 60s. This play is actually set during the Second World War, which I think colors the interactions between the characters in several ways. I don't want to get too specific about what the differences are, but if you're familiar with the film, this is a very, very different Breakfast at Tiffany's than what you might expect.
Natasha, introduce us to your character.
Well, I play Meg Wildwood. I am a Southern model. She's loud. She's obnoxious. She's got a stutter. One of the things that I noticed about her is that she is the jealous type. And she's also judgmental, extremely judgmental. So on my day job, I work for a bank. And therefore, I see a lot of people on a daily basis that have traits that I can pull from.
And what do you see as you step back then, Donna, as assistant director, about the interactions? Is Meg a foil? How does that all play out in terms of Holly and the various dynamics?
It's a strange dynamic between Holly and Meg. Like, at one point, they're trying to steal the attention away from each other, and they're spreading rumors about each other. And the other point, they're out on the stoop sending themselves being best friends. So it's very catty at times, and then other times, it's like, I don't know, girlfriends just having a night out. And it's strange to me. They turn on each other on a dime.
So she's sort of looking to put Holly in her place?
Jealousy is more from, say they're at a party and one is getting more attention than the other one will do something outlandish to try to outdo the other. And I can say that there are things about Meg that I see in myself and things that I despise about her. But overall, she's an enjoyable character to play.
Bill, how do you get a sense of creating a character who doesn't have a name? How have you come to terms with this character?
Well, Fred is extremely different from a lot of the characters I've played in a lot of ways. George Peppard, who plays Fred in the movie, does have a real name and is listed in credits by his real name. And he also plays him a very different way as he's written in the script. So as far as creating the character, while his name is not his own, a lot of the way he behaves throughout lends a lot to building that character. He's very unsure of himself within the scenes versus telling the story. He's very confident about what he's talking about. He sees himself in a certain light. It is his reminiscence, so what's happening is very ethereal. It's not really there. So you're seeing not what is happening in a down-to-reality sense. You're seeing it more his version of what happened. There's even a point in the play where he spins a yarn about what happened at a nightclub, and then he turns around and says, but that's not really what happened at all, I guess, kind of a thing. And he kind of leaves it ambiguous as to, is that him just saying what he wanted to happen, or did it really happen? So you get two versions of that. And I actually pitched this theory to John the other day via Facebook. I said, early on, we made this conclusion that Fred's the only person there talking to the audience. And I had this little epiphany during a rehearsal one night where I'm like, Fred's not even there. Breakfast at Tiffany's is the book that he wrote, and the audience is collectively reading the book. So Fred's not even really there. In essence, to get a little, I don't know, psychedelic, I guess you can say, the audience is going to look at an empty stage for the whole time because nobody's really there. They're just flipping pages in a book. So I thought that that was a really interesting way to put the final nail in the coffin as to who Fred is, because there's a part where he says that he's only comfortable writing about things of the past, so that he would be standing there telling people story after story about something that is of his present feels out of character for him. And that gave me the clue that the audience is reading his book, not listening to him have a conversation. Even the scenes that we believe are in the present are told after the fact. That's kind of how I view Fred. Like, he's bashful. He's unsure of himself. He's new to this big thing called writing. And he's an aspiring writer. He's not a success quite yet, according to the story within the story. So you get to play with that sense of anxiety that he has when he's talking to everybody around him, because he really doesn't fit into the world he's even creating for himself.
Take us back to Truman Capote and the title.
I guess the best way to explain it, it's an image that's in Holly's mind. The idea of having breakfast at Tiffany's. She has a rather long speech in the book and in the play about why Tiffany's specifically is such a special place to her, and how when what she calls the mean reds, when her life seems to close in around her, that's what she does to cheer herself up and make herself feel better, is she goes to Tiffany's. And of course, they keep that in the film with that iconic image of Audrey Hepburn eating a bagel or a Danish or something as she looks through the Tiffany's window. So it's obviously a phrase that we all have heard 30,000 times in our lives, but it's something that is very specifically meaningful to Holly's character.
Tell us a little bit more about who Holly is in the play.
I think I want to start this comment by saying one thing that anyone should remember, not just our cast. Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard and Mickey Rooney had a substantially different script. So obviously the performances are going to be different. Holly, I've been exploring the character with Jasmine. Holly has found a way to survive essentially by making people fall in love with her. And for her, that's her survival strategy. That's how she eats and gets along. And you have to pay attention, but we are told Holly at some point was badly hurt when she was a young girl. And now very rarely is she honestly herself around anyone. So the times when Holly is being Holly and being honest about who she is, those times always kind of stick out, because it's so different from this mask that she has crafted and constantly wears when she's around other people.
Holly in particular, you're trying to understand when she speaks how much of it is truth, how much of it is this falsehood she's putting on. And there's other characters as well. Some are so genuine and everything they say is true, but there are others that you're not sure.
And there's a realism to that, mm-hmm. I have to say, because everyone has a mask we put on at work. We put on when we're with our family, with our friends. And it's only when we're alone or maybe with the people that we truly trust that we can actually be ourselves.
What does Holly mean to Fred, Bill?
Well, he even says it himself in the play that Holly's a sign of things to come. She'll never belong to the past. It's something to always look forward to. I think that Holly is the unobtainable in a lot of ways. Like, he goes after her knowing he'll never get her. Just like I feel like he goes after his career knowing that there's a very good chance he will never get that. Of course, we kind of get the sense that he did because he, you know, writes the book, you could say. That's my interpretation of it. Whether or not that's how it's actually going on, I don't know. But that's how I'm building Fred in my head.
That's a good summary of Holly in general. I said earlier she survives by making people fall in love with her. And she gets people to fall in love with her by being unobtainable, or at least coming across as unobtainable.
What does the play tell us about our country at that time? You're both nodding, so take a turn, Meg.
There are a couple of references to the time period, particularly how our country treated people, which I think is very important given our society in its current climate.
You know, they mention in conversation about Mussolini and fascists and Nazis come up. So peppered throughout the play, you're still reminded we're in World War II time, and it doesn't go away. It's always in the background.
I think, not to disturb the narrative we all learned in school too much, I think we remember now, we try to remember our country as being a united people fighting World War II. That wasn't entirely true. As the play points out, because this is World War II in New York through the eyes of an aspiring writer who has just moved to the city. That's the entire backdrop. And there are Nazi sympathizers who appear throughout the play. There is not just a commentary, I think we see to a point how there was a real thread of racism. I was trying to think of a nicer word, but it's racism. that was, I think, more socially acceptable during the 40s than we like to admit now.
To a point that was used as comic relief in the film. And I'm not particularly happy. I mean, looking at it, it's a sign of the times. If you were to go back and watch Breakfast at Tiffany's or a James Bond movie, you have to see it through the eyes of the time in which it was created. But nowadays, I think we've become so placid that we don't realize this was once an issue and still is to a point.
Unfortunately, I think we see more similarities than we want to admit. I don't want to pick an exact period of time, but recently there seems to be a real push toward moving our society back to what our society was in the 50s and the 40s and in the back. And this play is a reminder that things really weren't as wonderful then as we are being told. That there isn't really a mythical, wonderful past that we've moved away from and need to get back to. That's not really there. And this play, I think, is a very honest look at American society while the war was going on. You know, I mean, for these characters, the war is kind of a backdrop to what they're doing in their lives, but it's still there, and it does affect the way they interact with each other.
So society's golden age thinking of, oh, there was a time before us where things were better and I want to be a part of that. We see the realism in this play that it's not all sunshine and roses, that there is a darkness to it, that compared to how we are now, we are better off.
John, I'd be interested in your reaction to what Fred said about the fact that the audience is, in a certain sense, reading the book.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's exactly right. The entire thing is, well, just like a book is in the author's head, this play is in Fred's head. And
things are constantly changing through it, as if it was stream of consciousness on a page and stream of consciousness in one's head, not so much a vivid recollection of the events that have passed.
Mm-hmm. That's why I made the technical decision early to go with minimal sets that would move quickly to keep that perspective fluid.
The other thing that I observed, I didn't observe it. I came upon it accidentally while studying my lines, the same way I came upon this whole idea that this is the thing that Fred was writing the whole time, was like, scenes don't have an ending. They just kind of stop. And I was actually on the stage rehearsing a scene with our Holly when I actually was jarred by the fact that Holly has a line and then Fred should have had a response but just ignores it and turns to the audience and starts talking. And that kind of struck me as like, that's very interesting that he did that he wrote that scene that way. Now, I don't know if that's just because that's how a chapter or a scene in the book ended, because this is lifted right out of the book, as John noted several times throughout rehearsal, or if that was the playwright's choice to do that. It really is jarring sometimes, because it gives it a hard sense to feel the fluidity as the narrator of the story, because suddenly you're just changing topics on a dime. And it's almost like, well, Fred wants to stop remembering that. Like, and there's a moment where he's having a conversation about a journal entry, and he just stops, and he's like, nah, I'm going to talk about something else now. It kind of ties into what you're asking about trying to build the role of the narrator. It's a really interesting story to tell. I like the way John's setting it up. I like the way the script sets it up, but it's challenging to juggle it all, because I think there's only one moment where Fred actually steps off stage, and there's only one scene where Fred doesn't interact with anybody. Other than that, like, he's constantly coming and going. Fred is constantly talking to the audience and constantly getting involved and constantly saying things, and it's fun. I like it. It's really challenging. It's frustrating, but it's fun.
I had thought about this, especially when we were starting, looking back on what I've directed recently with Farndale Avenue and Night of the Living Dead before that, and Heather's and the other shows. These were all not just that they were large shows. Their focus was the action. The central focus of these plays is not the characters. You don't need to know much about the characters for the story to move and have resonance. Tiffany's is focused entirely on the characters and the character portrayals, which means in the rehearsal process, we're spending a lot more time discussing how the characters feel and their motivations, and not just what they do, but why they do it, because there is so much more depth to it. This isn't just you're going over there because there's a zombie at the window, you know, where motivations are fairly easy to understand. Here they aren't all the time. And the proper portrayal of those kind of complex people, that's what makes this play worth watching.
We get a chance to see you and join you where and when.
We will be at the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts at the J.J. Ferrara Center at 212 West Broad Street in Hazleton. Our show opens September 14th and runs the 14th, 15th, and 16th, and then the 21st, 22nd, to 23rd. Showtimes on Friday and Saturday will be at 7 p.m., and on Sunday the shows will be at 3 p.m. There's a full dinner buffet, which is available the first weekend, 14th and 15th and 16th. Dinner on Friday and Saturday is at 5:30 and at 1:30 on Sunday. For reservations, call 570-454-5451 or go to ptpashows.org.
So while the film has a place in cinematic history, I would tell people who love the film, come give this play a chance. It's not going to be a carbon copy, but you don't want it to be. You want to come and see what the film was based on through the novel, and you want to see those characters and how their lives are portrayed.
If you love the story, this is a new way to experience it, and it's definitely worth your time.
Director John Sugart, Assistant Director Donna Wojtek, and actors Natasha Bogutsky, who is Mag Wildwood, and Bill Amos, Fred, in a production of Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's, adapted for the stage by Richard Greenberg, to be presented by the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts, September 14th, 15th, and 16th, 21st, 22nd, and 23rd, at the J.J. Ferrara Center, 212 West Broad Street in Hazleton. Showtimes 7 p.m. Fridays and Saturdays, 3 p.m. on Sundays. A full dinner buffet is available September 14th and 15th at 5:30 p.m., September 16th at 1:30 p.m. For more information, online, ptpashows.org, ptpashows.org. Truman Capote's Breakfast at Tiffany's, adapted for the stage, and it's the Pennsylvania Theater of Performing Arts in Hazleton, 212 West Broad Street, September 14th, 15th, and 16th, 21st, 22nd, and 23rd. For more information online, ptpashows.org.